So, week three, Jeremy Hymans. You're at Plugged and Unplanned. I'm Tony Nash, the CEO of Booktopia, and we have the author of the book New Power, or the co-author, along with his colleague Henry Timms, Jeremy Hymans. Now, we were talking last week about how businesses are working. I'm going to share with you now something which you may not have ever heard before, but I'm sure you and all listeners have heard of the concept of win-win. Mm-hmm. If we win and you win, then we all win together, and that is the way that the world works. It was like the beginning of New Power, I guess, in many ways, that expression, which was really from the 80s in terms of winners and losers, which is really the old power way. I kind of came up with an expansion on that, which is double win-win. Mm-hmm. And what that means is win-win, win-win. So, and I got that from observing and thinking about companies like Amazon and others, mm-hmm. and how Booktopia was going to be able to be a sustainable business. Mm-hmm. So for systems to work, and in particular Booktopia actually needs to win. We need to be profitable. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to, therefore we're sustainable. But for us to be winning, we also actually need our publishers and our suppliers mm-hmm. to win.
Yep.
We need the customers to win. They want to know they're buying at a good price and that they're getting fair value. And our employees need to win. Mm. And when I think about Amazon, the way that they operate, they play win-win, lose-lose. Mm. Amazon wins, the customer wins, the supplier loses, and the employee loses. Mm. Because you hear of those war stories in terms of
both. The reporting on that has been pretty stunning, hasn't it?
That's right. So, and I don't know how mythical it is in terms of ambulances waiting out the side of Amazon fulfillment centers at Christmas, but that's what they make up, or that could actually be the truth or close to it. So, but the same suppliers, it's like in Australia where you have Woolies and Coles pushing and pressuring the milk and the egg farmers to squeeze, mm-hmm. so then they can use those products which are absolutely required by Australians to have the cheapest price to get them into the store so they're buying everything else. Mm-hmm. So that idea of having double win-win, have you ever heard of that before?
I haven't heard of that. I think it's a great formulation. I think it's very consistent with those players that are using New Power in ways that I would say are sustainable, because you can quickly get people engaged, collaborating, participating, but if you then become very transactional, you'll lose. But it's so interesting hearing you say that. The thing that I immediately thought is how different that is to Donald Trump's worldview, which is very much there are winners and losers. So he can't conceive of a world in which you have a win-win. Everyone has, if he wins, someone else has to lose. And we live in this world where those two worldviews are very much in tension. And that's part of why the world at the moment, I think, is so combustible. Because these two very different worldviews are colliding in politics, in business, in culture. And we're struggling with that transition.
Yeah, because it's not, by its definition, having a loser, it's not sustainable.
Yes.
You cannot have people continuing to lose. And for that, so people need to be winning at some point. Mm-hmm. So why not make everyone win?
Yes.
Because then if Booktopia is winning, the supplier is winning, the customer is winning, our employees are winning, like you can keep going on forever.
Well, it's a long-term view, right? It requires a sort of discipline, and it requires a faith in people, a belief in people. Mm-hmm. So if you see people as kind of just, chess pieces, you're not going to do that. So it very much depends on the values of the leader. In the book, we talk about the qualities of a New Power leader, and they're different because in a world where, you had full control of everything that happened, and you really only thought about, the people in your immediate remit, the people on your payroll, your suppliers. But now there's this much bigger world you have to think about how you shape. Your brand, your reputation can get shaped in a day by a social media current sweeping over you if you're not living up to your values. We have this term that we use, which is that organizations and indeed leaders need to occupy themselves before they themselves are occupied. So they need to imagine their harshest critic can see the inside of their organization and really then think, am I actually living in that way? Because the reality is that's going to happen to most businesses in this new power world of radical transparency. There's a funny story, actually, that might give your readers a chuckle that really is kind of the extreme version of this. So there's a politician currently running for governor of Arizona in the US, and he decided to occupy himself before he was occupied. So on his campaign website, he created a section preemptively called Scandal and Controversy. And he basically had led a rather colourful life, so he listed in extraordinary detail, you know, his sexual history. You know, and there'd been all sorts of interesting things that he'd done that were a little unconventional. And he just comes out with it, and he says, you know what, this is everything. No one can occupy me because I've occupied myself. And it was a very effective strategy for him because he got it all out there, and he framed it in his own terms by saying, look, I wish everybody else had the same freedom that I've enjoyed. Mm-hmm. So we don't all want to be Noah Dyer, but you see how different a strategy that is to the strategy of let's get the lawyers to draft a carefully worded statement, let's say as little as possible, let's be as uncontroversial as possible. Think about Nike that just came out with this ad featuring Colin Kaepernick, the NFL star, who's an incredibly polarizing figure in the US. So people who support Donald Trump think he's the demon, right? You know, I happen to think he's very inspiring. But they went ahead and they leaned into the controversy. And in that new power world, this ability to generate real intensity of support, even if some people are left behind by that, turns out to be a better strategy than just being bland and not offending anyone.
That's interesting. So what you're saying is that if you... It's kind of like if you believe in it, then... Be strong, be committed to that.
Rather, be bold about it.
Yeah, rather than just simply being nice about it or being like, I know I believe in that, and maybe that's not to everyone's liking.
Right.
And therefore, but I'm going to just be who I am. But that's obviously Donald Trump. He does do that.
He does. And so that's been very effective for him. So, you know, you don't... people are using these new power strategies... This is the irony of Trump. I said earlier that Trump sees the world in winner and loser terms. Very true. He thinks like an authoritarian, but he also understands how new power works. He understands that you want to give people more of that freedom.
I mean, how much
you want to generate intensity?
Because Twitter, I mean, he uses it all the time.
Yeah.
Like no other politician ever.
Right.
Has used it, and he's using it. It must feel like for all the people that are part of the White House system and part of the U.S. Senate, that this guy is completely out of control.
Oh, I think they do, don't they? Just 2 days ago, the op-ed in the New York Times. I mean, how extraordinary that you have someone writing an anonymous op-ed from inside the most senior ranks of the White House, basically saying help. I mean, it's surreal, but that's right. So he's breaking all the rules, but he is the master of harnessing this new power crowd. He's not scared of controversy, and he is good at giving people, his supporters, a sense of their own power and agency. He doesn't try to control them. And I'm not recommending we all behave like Donald Trump. That's the last thing I'm recommending. But I am saying that if you have core values like that are positive, you should try to activate people around those values, even if it offends some people. The way Qantas got behind marriage equality here in Australia, Qantas is the national airline. You know, they were sure to offend some people who oppose marriage equality, but they made the decision that they needed to make a stand on their values, and that would generate more intensity of positive support for them that would outweigh the negative. And I think that equation, that payoff, just looks different now because of social media and because of this new power that's flowing everywhere. Whereas it's probably true that 30 years ago, if you were a corporate, your best strategy was to kind of keep your head down. I don't think that's true anymore.
It's interesting because with Booktopia and marriage equality, which I personally absolutely believe in, as does all of the executive here, but to then be a platform, especially the size of the company that we are,
yeah.
We're big, but we're not big enough to then be able to, like a Qantas, to be able to make it stand like that.
Right.
This is who we are. And whether you do or you don't, no one's going to move the mountain.
Yeah.
Because they are big. They have the, so I would feel somewhat limited on what we can say based on the size that we are today. Now, if we were a $1 billion company and we were, that's our kind of place in the world to be
use that influence
to be able to use that influence, then maybe it would be different. So I am respectful of where we're at to ensure that we don't offend our customers who we work very hard to inspire, because we have people from all faiths, all beliefs, levels of society buying from us, to educate themselves, to entertain themselves, escape, to find out about where they're going to travel next. I mean, that's what we do. And so therefore it's interesting to then be, and given that we do create a lot of content like we're doing today, and we have people who work in our book team who are writing blogs and unique content. So it's about it's about knowing what you can and cannot do. I mean, there are some authors that we do not support. We do not like what they're saying. We cannot endorse them.
Do you stock them?
We may not stock. There's some that we may not stock. That we remove from the site as well, so that someone who really wants it can't even order it, because
How do you draw the line on that?
Things like, for example, if someone believes in pedophilia,
right?
You know, or someone believes in racism, to the detriment of others, it just goes totally against our principles,
right?
So, the beauty of the world and the freedom of speech, that they still have other means of being able to get access to that content. Yep. It's just not through us.
Got it. Yeah.
But I mean, even for ourselves, we have this is a good one. Because Hitler and Trump, they're not similar, but in terms of the way that they inspire or get crowds of people to think a certain way, there is some similarities there in the way that they go about doing things in igniting thinking. But I have a Jewish background, and many of my ancestors were murdered in the Holocaust, but we don't remove Mein Kampf from our website because people need to...
it's an educational
document. It's a historical...
So people need to understand...
In
order to prevent... That's been one of the reasons why these new demagogues have emerged. Because people have forgotten the lessons of the 20th century, which is really striking to me. So, you know, my father's a Holocaust survivor. If you have that experience, you're shaped by that understanding that that kind of tragedy, that kind of abuse of power can arrive in history at your doorstep. And I think one of the challenges with the Trump election was a lot of millennial age people just had no template for what could happen when authoritarians or demagogues came to power. And I think it's a really important thing, actually, to educate people. And that does require people to engage with the reality of these texts.
Yeah, so it is interesting. I mean, and books, of course, are very much a part of connecting people with history and the lessons that are learned. So in your own book, you've written a book, and so in terms of Henry and yourself, I mean, you know, how did you battle it out? Who got to say what, or did it come? Was it very organic? Did it come naturally? Did both of you look at it and go, "That feels right"? How did you do the process?
It was a really wonderful process. I mean, I think we both feel like the book is way better than it would have been if either of us had written it alone. But that required a lot of creative tension. So you have a lot of, we just spent a lot of time thinking through ideas together. We had a principle when we were writing the book of the double key. Both of us had to really endorse it if it was going to go in the book. And so if there was something that one of us thought was great and the other one was like, don't think that really works, it didn't go in the book. And so often then the best work in the book was, okay, you know, how do we really distill in a simple way, in a clear way for a reader, how to build a movement or, you know, how to think about money differently. Each of those chapters required a sort of a framework, a unifying idea that really could connect with people. That was just iteration after iteration. It was getting on a whiteboard. It was distilling. It was, and that process of doing that was very much together. And the writing of the book was also very much together. So one of us might take the first pass on a particular section, but then the next pass would always be the other person. So by the time something landed in the book, it had been turned over so many times, I couldn't even tell you anymore, you know, what I originally wrote and what Henry did. Mm. And so that, I think, is exactly the right approach. Certainly it was right for us when you're collaborating. I feel like the good thing about it was, you know, in a way we modeled part of what we're talking about in the book, which is how do you do collaboration effectively? And we learned together. It's not easy, but I think we learned together how to collaborate in a way that got to a much better outcome than if either of us had just been working on our own.
It's interesting because when you, although completely in a different subject, but when I first met my wife, we got married a few years ago, we met several years ago, and I was absolutely dead set sure that she was the one for me. and so, but when we moved in together after, and with our kids, they're 1 week with us and 1 week with the other parents. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, when we started to kind of realize that this was a relationship, we started looking at artwork.
Huh.
And, you know, what art are we going to have? And the art that I had in my own place and the art that she liked.
Yeah, totally different.
Totally different.
Yeah.
And so, see, that's proof we're not supposed to be together. We'll never be able to buy art together. And my response to her having, she's Greek and therefore there's a lot of emotion. I said, I tell you what, when we find something that we both like,
yeah,
we're going to buy it.
Double key. Yeah. And did you find some?
And we have found some amazing pieces of art. I mean, yeah. We don't have a high budget. It's not about that. It's about that we buy things that we like. And this formula,
yeah,
and this agreement is so supportive. Now, there's probably things that she's bought for herself outside of that, but the things that we've actually bought together is amazing. Really, really amazing.
That's a great story.
I want to ask you this because we're coming closer to the end of our journey. Do you know how many books you've sold?
Not really yet. I mean, I have a sense of magnitude. The book's a bestseller in the US, and it's been selling really well around the world. But I actually couldn't give you a precise number.
Hundreds of thousands, 200,000.
It's this is the funny thing is we made a decision not to get that information very often, because we felt that if we started focusing too much on the sales, we would become really narrowly focused on that rather than on the influence of the book. So some of the information I have is like 2-3 months old. I can try to tabulate it for you and let you know. But
it's more, it was a bit of a leading question. The reason why, before you came in, I thought, yeah, I'd just log on to the Australian database just to see how many.
I don't know how many we've sold in Australia.
To my shock and horror,
yeah,
it's only 3,000.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
There must have been others outside that, yes, bulk businesses are buying, that, but through the bookstores.
Ah, that's interesting. And through the, I definitely know that it's a lot more than that. But maybe, as you say, maybe it's different channels.
Yeah, so there could be like literally a big bank or a big company says, yeah, you need to read this book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, and they've bought probably direct from the publisher, right, 1,000 copies or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
let's just say, because the database that we have access to is, yeah, all the bookstores in Australia,
uh-huh,
online and physical bookstores.
Yeah.
It was 3,000, including the hardcovers that might come from overseas. The reason why I say that, I want to share that with you, yeah, and to the people who are listening, what's exciting to me, yeah, is that, and for those that have been listening, if it resonates with you that this is actually going on,
yes,
and this idea and the principles around New Power, and, yeah, for those that get to read it now,
yeah,
and get in early,
yeah,
right, that is my recommendation to anyone who's been listening and go, hold on a second, I want to know that, and I want to know it before other people know it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important reminder, because around the rest of the world, we're in lag.
Yeah, because that's true.
Because now, maybe because the two of you, I know you're Aussie and you're back here in Australia, but probably because you've been based overseas.
Mostly focused overseas. I just came from Brazil.
There you go.
So there we are. No, it's great. I mean, I want more people in Australia to read this book, because I think it's really important in the Australian context. So I'm excited to get this book into the hands of more Aussies.
Mm, yeah. So thank you so much for coming in. It's been wonderful.
It's been a great conversation, and thanks for your support, and a big admirer of what you've done here and what you've built. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.